chanson. Écoutez et répétez.
Well, I love cubism. It's my favorite style. When I see a cubist painting, I just gotta smile. But there's one painter I'm his biggest fan. He's the father of cubism. His name's Cézanne. Cézanne, the father of cubism. Well, some people say that it was Picasso. Other people claim it was the Chirico. Some people think it was Modigliani.
Okay, good morning. Well, I have a sculptor who is a poet here and an archivist who is an artist also, and other things that you do, don't you, Stacy? And that is Keith Jellum, who's here with me this morning, and Stacy Fletcher. And we're going to talk about Hilla Morris and the wonderful show that is right now down at the Portland Art Museum. And I think it's there till the 27th of July. I'm not sure now here. I'll have to give you the times for that a little bit later. But we want to concentrate on the people who these people's relationship to Hilda Morris and the way she was, who she was, and what her art was made of, and that's also includes her life and times. We're going to have the life and times of Hilda Morris this morning, I hope. I want to tell you who Stacy Fletcher is. She's a fourth generation Portlander. She is the daughter of architect William Fletcher. Did you know that, Keith?
No, I didn't. I'm glad to hear it, though.
And William Fletcher was a musician as well as an architect.
Yeah, I think I met him once, but I have a vague memory of it.
So. He was a great man.
Yeah.
He was on the board of Pacific Northwest College Friends, and I was one of those at one time, the Pacific Northwest College. And that's down there at the school. And you went to the school for a while?
Yeah, for a brief time. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the 60s, early 60s.
Okay. And then Stacy, who is the relation to Bill Fletcher, in fact, his daughter, she has a degree in fine art from Aarhus Art Academy in Denver.
Denmark. Yeah.
And she is a board member emeritus, Contemporary Crafts Museum and Gallery, and an archival assistant to Hilda Morris in the 1980s, and an occasional helper. She is administrator of the Carl and Hilda Morris Foundation and liaison to the Portland Art Museum for the Hilda Morris Retrospective, which is there now. And she is also in process of preparing the Morris Archives for the Archives of American Art at the Smithsonian Institute.
Yes.
Wow.
Exciting.
I'm so glad you have that job, but I think it's an ongoing effort, isn't it?
It is an ongoing effort.
And you keep discovering things?
Oh, so much. Every time you turn a corner, there's another set of letters, there are more papers. But the process of putting the retrospective together was fabulous because we in depth went through all of that work. So it will be going to the Smithsonian in the next year.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we're going to find out more about Hilda Morris and your association with her and
yes.
What kind of a person she was.
Yeah.
And you're going to bring her alive for us.
I hope so.
So okay. The show is going to the Smithsonian?
No, the archives are going to the Smithsonian. Archives. So they will be accessible to people that want to research Hilda and Carl.
Yeah. Do you know anything about what's going to happen with this? I mean, is this the only group showing of this batch of work that's going to be around? Or is it?
I believe so. This one at the Portland Art Museum is all that's slated for this show. Uh-huh. Laura Russo Gallery has a show of Hilda that will be opening in June. So look for that also. Uh-huh.
Okay. And then we know Keith Jellum has been on before, and he's, as well as being a painter, he has done the weather vane sculptures.
I'm not a painter.
I don't.
I'm not a poet either.
You're not?
I have a piece downtown called The Electronic Poet, which I did in, I think, 87 for the city. And that scrolls poetry across, you know, custom-made LED screen. I know a lot of poets, but I'm not a poet.
I'm sorry.
So,
okay.
But I am a sculptor. So
all right.
I'll go with that.
All right. And we do want to talk for just a minute about the electronic poet, Ben. The electronic poet is not you. It is something we're looking at. On the mall, right?
Yeah, right. The electronic poet is a piece of sculpture that's on Morrison Street at a light rail stop between 9th and 10th. And it's made out of bronze. And then I worked in conjunction with Joe Betts, who's an electronic genius of sorts, and when he was 20 years old. And he built the inboard computer and a custom-made LED screen on one side of the piece. The piece hangs underneath a soffit over the sidewalk, so it's outside where all the people are waiting to get on the train. So it scrolls. It has an inboard computer, and then I have a remote computer that I plug different poetry programs into, and they scroll across the screen. And so the people standing there waiting for the train have something to do, while they're waiting. And I programmed it. I've changed the program every 6 months or so for the last, 19 years.
That's, 19 years.
It's getting a little long in the tooth, but and it's still running. The clock's acting up on it a little bit, and so it shuts off kind of at random sometimes. But normally it runs for 18 hours a day, and.
How do you decide who you're going to put on the computer?
Well, that's the position I'm sort of uncomfortable with because
what's
makes
up
me,
there now
makes me into an editor.
Uh-huh.
What's up there now is a bunch of entries that I took out of a diary of a Yugoslav revolutionary guy who is sort of on the run. Some 15 years ago or so from the authorities, and he let me read his diary, and it was when he was in prison. He thought he was going to be killed for being revolutionary, and so I took some excerpts out of that, and that's what's running up there now. His name is Zemak Faccio, and it's very interesting.
It is very interesting. Mm-hmm. And so be sure to check that out, people. Even the people on the gorge, come down next time you're here and check out The Electronic Poet.
Should I give like a brief history of Hilda and where she came from and how she turned up in Portland?
Yes, I'm going to ask you to do that.
Okay.
Do you want to do that right now?
Sure. Why don't
I
start in with that? And that kind of gives a... ground to work from.
So we don't get lost.
Yeah.
That would be good.
So Hilda was born in New York City, and she, her father was a violinist, so she was surrounded by music her whole life. She was very influenced by her mathematics professor. And one of the things that she said later that did was made her aware of abstraction. And this is an interest that carried with her throughout her life, and I think really kind of pushed her as an artist into the abstract form and seeing its direct connection to real life. And so she studied with at Cooper Union together with
Concetta Scarvaglioni.
Yeah, a fabulous...
A tiny, mighty woman.
Right.
Who has some huge sculpture in New York City.
Right. Yeah. And I know she was a great role model of Hilda's. And this was in the 1930s. So there was a lot going on in the 1930s. There was the Museum of Modern Art was starting off with shows of people like Henry Moore, a lot of that more modernist sculpture that she got a chance to see. And then during WPA, she was offered the chance to go to an art center in the West, which is the Spokane Art Center, and to teach sculpture. And she did this. And now this is quite a travel to get on the train from New York City and go to Spokane, Washington. Mm-hmm. And along the way in her diaries, you can see the drawings that she made out of the train window of the monumental landscape that she saw. And I think that this is really the beginning of what carried on throughout her career of being aware of forms in nature.
Okay. I want to be sure to get Keith in on some of the process.
Right.
Because that's very important.
Most definitely.
The philosophical and visual nature of the sea things.
Right.
And, in fact, everything.
So, just briefly, she went to Spokane, met painter Carl Morris, who was the head of the Spokane Art Center then, and when that closed a year later, moved to Seattle. At where they became friends with that group of people. Dr. Fuller, who was starting the Seattle Art Museum, was a great supporter of this young group of artists. Mark Tobey became their lifelong friend. Callahan, that group that is also known as the Northwest Mystics,
yes,
were their close friends. And from there, they ended up in Portland and beginning her work, in which Keith then came into the scene in what? The 60s?
Yeah, sometime in I started my foundry in 64, I think. I built my own foundry in my basement down the Corbett Street area, and started casting my own stuff, and then word got out and some other people started coming to me to cast their pieces, like Manuel Esquerdo and Hilda and Fred Lippmann and some other sculptors around town. And so we got pretty well acquainted during that period of time from, say, 67 to 73. 73, I left Portland and wound up in Mexico City for a while and then in Arizona, and I kind of lost track with Hilda over that period of time. But for that period of time, she was from like 67 to 73 was when we had a close friendship. And one thing that I was always impressed with, it always just kind of amazed me, is that she had such an incredible sense of scale. Even her small maquettes look like they should be 12 feet high or something like that. And that's very unusual, I think. I mean, as a sculptor, scale is something I think about all the time, and I do public commissions, and scale is always a very critical thing. You know, is this better at 10 feet, or should it be 5 feet, or should it be 20 feet, or what's going to work, you know, for not only this idea, but for the site. And I was always just kind of amazed at being in her studio and casting things for her, that she had all these little pieces around, and all of them were just kind of bursting with this desire to be bigger. And that's a very unusual quality, I think, for a sculptor.
She was a little person herself, wasn't she?
But small. She was monumental.
Yes.
That's a very good analogy. She was small, but she had... I mean, her feelings, her philosophy, her thoughts, her ideas, her titles for her pieces. You can see the poet in Hilda when you see the titles for a lot of her pieces, like the Muted Harp, which is such a lovely
yes.
idea. It's not just silent harp, it's a muted harp, something mm-hmm. that's keeping it from sounding.
Under control.
And then, mm-hmm. you know, Sea Oracle is titled to some of her pieces, and I loved her Sea Oracle series.
I love those too.
And then there's all this wind and sails that comes into all of her work that's really a major part. I mean, those things were just coming out of her, out of Hilda, and whether it happened when she left New York and traveled across the country to Spokane. I mean, she goes from growing up in New York and comes to Spokane, Washington. That must have been a shock, but the landscape and the Columbia River Gorge and the ocean and just all of that, I think, were in music from her father. And she always had music going in her studio, or at least she did when I was around. But that was really an incredible part of who she was. She was an elemental force, I think. And it's really wonderful to have that show at the museum to be able to trace this life force and using sculpture as her language. And just, it's a gift. And if you're interested in sculpture, and if you're interested in form, as far as sculpture goes, then I think you should check out Hilda's work and see its transmigration between the different ideas that she had.
Why do you think she was not a very important person in her own time?
Before
it wasn't discovered until quite recently.
I don't think you necessarily get discovered from if you're making sculpture in Portland, Oregon. I mean,
well,
the magazines that come out and the PR factories, you know, are in L.A. and New York and Chicago or whatever. But you could be doing something very interesting, and who would care? Because nobody would pick up on it. And so I think her work is, it fits right in with what else was going on in the world of sculpture, but it's not, you know, she didn't become famous and rich. She struggled along like we all do, you know, being an artist in a small town in Oregon.
Well, you know. But in the 50s, she was acknowledged. She got a Ford Foundation grant, which was a very, very prestigious thing.
Okay.
And they kept connections with their associates in New York. If they go to New York, they would visit with Martha Rothko. They were friends with Joseph Campbell. They had a community that they built throughout the country that nurtured them while they lived in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was recognition. Of course, she was always up against the feeling that she was a woman needing to stand on her own, wanting to be seen as an equal with the men in her field. And so being a feminist without wanting that label to her.
Right. She very much resented being called a feminist.
Or a woman artist.
She was
an artist.
Okay.
And it was deeply, deeply ingrained in everything she did. And so there was recognition. But then I think eventually where she lived, their choice of being in Oregon did keep them from getting the ultimate recognition that they should. And hopefully the show at the museum will start writing some of that.
Good. We never mentioned Carl Morris himself, who was very famous in his own time and known internationally, was he not?
Yes, he was well known during those times too. Yes. And you know, they showed in exhibitions that were juried exhibitions throughout the country and internationally, which during that time in the 50s was a major thing to do.
Did Hilda and Carl ever discuss their work with each other?
Oh, yes.
All the time?
Yes.
Yeah.
And their work, the way they talked about their work was not just, you know, I'm making this piece. It was a dialogue about the world, philosophy, psychology, poetry, those you know, all those things drove their work. So there was a constant dialogue. And Keith might.
Yeah.
Well, I one little side note. I always thought that, you know, if this were a democratic monarchy in this country, that Hilda would be the one that I'd vote for queen, because she had a dignity and intellect, intelligence, huge intelligence, and wit and grace about her. She had all those things that she was just a very extraordinary person, and also a very good sculptor. So
yes. I met her a couple of times at parties and so forth. She was a tiny but very strong, like you were saying. She was exactly as you depicted her, actually. And I asked her if she wanted to be, at that time I just started this show on KBOO, which was, that would be 21 years ago. And I called her on the phone, invited her.
And did she come?
And she, no, she would not come. And but she talked to me for an hour on the phone.
Right.
And I realized that she was, just as you said, she was a very intelligent woman, read a lot, had a great sense of humor. And we had a good time, but I couldn't get her to come on the show.
And she was a kind of a poet at heart, I think. That was my feeling being around her. I just sensed this poetry. She had a lot of poet friends, Carolyn Kaiser and Robert Skelton and people like that. But you can just see in her work the poetry in her work and in her titles, and that's very attractive.
You sure can. It's a kind of a magical thing to see, and you helped her with that. Now tell me how you helped her with the process. I want to hear about the blues inside of some of those figures and what you did to get to help her get those. You told me.
I didn't.
We stood there looking at.
Yeah.
The drum or whatever. The drum.
There are some pieces in this show, some smaller maquettes that I cast. But I didn't do the patining. I gave her the pieces back. Just in lost wax process, you make the, you know, you make molds of the original, and then you make wax patterns, and then you vent and gate it, and you invest it in a refractory mold and put it in the burnout oven, and it takes 2 or 3 days to melt the wax out and dry the mold out, and then you pull it out and you pour your metal in, and then everything that was wax turns to bronze, and then you have to break that mold off, and you have to cut all the vents and gates off and sandblast the piece, and then you do finish work on it and patina it. But she always did that part herself, and because she had some knowledge about what she wanted, and it's sort of a mystical process.
Mystical, good word.
Doing patinas.
Yeah.
For
and
me.
A lot of mystical that I think that appeals to me the most is the real feeling of the sea, the thoughtfulness of the sea, and what it does to shapes and colors. And so I just envisioned her. How did she get that texture with cement? The cement.
Well,
texture.
I asked her one time why she never worked in clay, and she said, "Oh, it's too easy." And I think there was something in her that wanted to struggle with the materials, you know, as part of her process. She wanted something she could push against, and texture is a huge factor in almost all of her work. You never see anything that's real smooth. In fact, I was interested in these tribal rites series, which I had never seen before this show. It was real interesting.
Oh,
and I'm curious to ask
colored figures.
Ask Stacy about what kind of thing, because they separate so much from her other work and what kind of a process her brain was going through at that period of time, 87, 88.
Yeah, well, I think they separate from her other work, but they also really connect. They connect to the early, the 50s cement pieces, almost totem-like pieces, which there are a couple of in the art museum show. She was also toying with thoughts of her friends and the people that she knew. So each one of those sculptures has a very distinct personality that she was working with while she was making them. Mm-hmm. And these were some of the last works that she did. They were very, very playful for her, though serious, but she just kind of burst forth into this new almost homage to her friends and wanting to make this gathering.
Mm. And she was always interested, like a lot of us are. She says, wouldn't it be nice if we could all just get all of our friends together and go off and live on an island together? And she was really felt a tight connection with a lot of friends and wanted to live in a different culture where you could control, had more control over the environment. But I was curious, did she know, when did she find out that she was sick? And she,
I think she was sick off and on for quite a few years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but did she talk about her different feeling about this batch of work? I mean, it separates.
Not really. Watched her have so much joy in making it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then the whole theme of the figure, when you look at the show, you can see it, the figure in almost every piece. Mm-hmm. Very, very strong. So I also...
We're going to have to wind up. You have 1 minute.
Okay. I quickly want to say there's a fabulous book that was produced by the Art Museum.
Yes.
For the retrospective that I hope people will look at. Hilda is monumental.
Susan Fellinier and Bruce Gunther.
Yes, and David
together.
Morris, yes.
And it's a book you should have in your library, very definitely.
Most definitely.
About a wonderful woman who was a great sculptor. And the Great Sculptors Show is at the Portland Art Museum right now until July 16th. So get thee down there, because July 16th is coming upon us very soon. And I'd like to thank Keith Jellum.
Thank you, Julie.
For coming this morning.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it very much.
I was happy to be here.
Having a lot of other things that you need to do. Mm-hmm. And Stacy Fletcher, thank you so much, the archivist.
For having us. Yeah.
And we'll be looking forward to seeing more of your work.
Yeah.
We'll be reading a book.
Yeah.
And this is Julie Bernard and Art Focus.
Écoutez, répétez. Well, I love cubism. It's my favorite style, and I see a cubist painting. I've just got a smile. But there's one painter I'm his biggest fan. He's the father of cubism. His name's...
And that concludes, well, actually, we have one more thing on the radio zine this morning, and that is Democracy Now!, looking at a proposed legislation that would rewrite Internet privacy rules and require service providers to track what users do online, and also the proposed changes by the Environmental Protection Agency that would dismantle the program, essentially. That all next on Democracy Now! Right here on KBOO 90.7 Portland, Oregon. Stay tuned. From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
He was one of the first NSA directors to really make an effort to get to know the press corps in Washington and to really have a public, give the NSA a public face. And he constantly was out there saying, you know, we don't spy on Americans. We never would spy on Americans. We follow the law.
General Michael Hayden faces a Senate confirmation hearing today to become the next director of the CIA. As head of the National Security Agency, Hayden oversaw the Bush administration's secret domestic surveillance program. We'll talk with the Center for National Security Studies. Then will Congress force internet service providers to spy on you? And will the public lose its right to know about toxic releases by industry? Congress is poised to vote on these issues. And as violence intensifies in Somalia, is the U.S. funding warlords?
In an environment of instability, as we've seen in the past, Al-Qaeda may take root, and we want to make sure that Al-Qaeda does not, in fact, establish a beachhead in Somalia.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Senate's face has voted to build a fence along parts of the Mexico border to prevent undocumented workers from entering the country. In total, 370 miles of triple-layered barriers would be added near San Diego and in the Arizona desert. Senators also approved a provision that would prevent undocumented immigrants from petitioning for a guest worker permit without the sponsorship of an employer. And in a unanimous vote, Senate accepted an amendment that would bar granting work permits to undocumented immigrants convicted of either a felony or at least three misdemeanors. The measure would affect even those who ignored a court deportation order. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting the Bush administration is preparing to turn to several military contractors for a planned virtual fence along the border. Companies including Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman have announced they'll bid on the multi-billion dollar contracts within weeks. The virtual fence would place unmanned aerial vehicles, ground surveillance satellites, and motion detection video equipment in isolated areas along the Mexican and Canadian border. According to the Times, the Bush administration will ask contractors not just to supply equipment, but to devise and build a whole new border strategy. Earlier this year, Homeland Security Deputy Secretary Michael Jackson told military industry leaders, quote, "We're asking you to come back and tell us how to do our business." In Afghanistan, more than 40 people were killed in fighting between Taliban members and Afghan and foreign forces in two southern provinces Wednesday. The dead included a dozen police, a Canadian soldier, and more than 30 militants. Aid groups are warning tens of thousands of people in the Congo province of Katanga are at risk from fighting between armed groups. More than 300,000 displaced people have been left in limbo by clashes that have destroyed scores of villages. This is Beatrice Exley of the International Committee of the Red Cross.
The people are coming back and they need help to reconstruct their lives, to reconstruct huts, to be able to start again their life here back in the villages.
In the occupied territories, Hamas has deployed a new militia in Gaza over the objections of the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. The new force is led by Jamal Abu Samarhana, a Hamas figure who is high on Israel's wanted list. Hamas says the new force will restore order. The move threatens to increase tensions between Hamas and the Abbas-led Fatah. This week, two Hamas members were killed in drive-by shootings blamed on Fatah militants. Back in the United States, jurors have begun deliberating in the fraud and conspiracy trial of former Enron executives Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling. The two are accused of overseeing one of the worst cases of corporate corruption in U.S. history. On Wednesday, Lay was questioned as he left the courtroom.
I think we've told a lot of it. It's just too bad that so much of it continues to be distorted, twisted, and turned. But I guess that's just all part of our system. But we'll keep working at it.
You think you've got a fair trial?
I think probably we've got the fair trials you're going to get, yes. Thank you.
Here in New York, a former deputy mayor in the Giuliani administration has filed a medical claim for respiratory illnesses contracted by pollution at the World Trade Center site. The man, Rudy Washington, worked in the area around Ground Zero for several weeks after the towers fell. In Oklahoma Wednesday, 16 people were arrested outside the annual meeting of the oil and gas services company Halliburton. The demonstrators were charged with trespassing after they left the designated protest area to attempt what they called a citizen's arrest on Halliburton chief executive Barry Lazar. Meanwhile, inside the meeting, shareholders rejected a proposal by a group of Texas and Kansas shareholders to adopt a policy based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The New York Times is reporting the Bush administration is considering entering into negotiations with North Korea that would lead to a possible peace treaty. According to aides, President Bush is likely to approve the new approach, which would go back to his previous pledge to refuse dealing with North Korea until it gave up its nuclear program. A senior Asian official told the Times the initiative may be prompted by the Bush administration's views on Iran. A classified national intelligence estimate on North Korea, which was circulated among senior officials earlier this year, concluded that the North had probably fabricated the fuel for more than a half dozen nuclear weapons since the beginning of Mr. Bush's administration, was continuing to produce roughly a bomb's worth of new plutonium each year. The official said, quote, there's a sense that they can't leave Korea out there as a model for what the Iranians hope to become, a nuclear state that can say no to outside pressure. And the BBC is still feeling the effects of an embarrassing gaffe that made it to air last week. On May 8th, a man named Guy Goma showed up for a job interview for a technology-related position at the BBC. A mix-up led producers to believe Guy Goma, the job applicant, was in fact Guy Cooney, a technology website editor who was scheduled to appear for a live interview. Well, it turns out they had the wrong guy.
So what does this all mean for the industry and the growth of music online? Well, Guy Cooney is the editor of the technology website News Wireless. Hello, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Were you surprised by this verdict today?
I'm very surprised to see this verdict to come on me, because I was not expecting that. When I came, they told me something else, and I'm coming. You got an interview there, so it's a big surprise anyway.
A big surprise.
The intended guy, Guy Cooney, watched the interview from the green room where he was waiting to go on. The BBC later apologized to viewers and invited Guy Goma back for a follow-up interview. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the nation.